This is the Sunday Catholic Word, a production of Catholic Answers, the only podcast to look at the Sunday Mass readings from an apologetics perspective.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Sunday Catholic Word, a podcast where we reflect on the upcoming Sunday Mass readings and pick out the details that are relevant for explaining and defending our Catholic faith. I'm Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and the host for this podcast. In this episode, we're going to focus on three details. One comes from the first reading, taken from Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 through 17, which records God's deliverance of the Ten Commandments. He's given the Ten Commandments there. The related apologetical topic is having religious statues within our religious spaces. Another comes from the second reading, taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 22 through 25, and it has to do with whether God approves of philosophical reasoning. Finally, the third detail comes from the gospel reading, which is John's report of Jesus' overturning of the money changer tables in the temple, recorded in his gospel, chapter 2, verses 13 through 25. And the related apologetical topic here is the historicity of John's gospel. So let's start with the first reading. I'm not going to read the whole passage since there's only one line that I want to focus on, namely God's instruction that the Israelites not have any quote-unquote graven images, as some translations have it. Now, as many of you listening already probably know, Protestants often appeal to this verse as a challenge to the Catholic practice of putting statues and images in their churches and using them in their private devotions. How can the Catholic Church approve of religious statues, so the argument goes, when the Bible forbids having graven images? As I point out in my book, Meeting the Protestant Challenge, How to Answer 50 Biblical Objections to Catholic Beliefs, there are two ways that we can meet this challenge. The first way is to prove that God can't be condemning religious statues and images in an absolute sense, because elsewhere in the Bible, he explicitly commands making them. Consider, for example, the two gold cherubim, cast sculptures of angels, that God commanded to be put on the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, as we read in Exodus chapter 25, verses 18 through 20. God also instructed that cherubim be woven into the curtains of the tabernacle, according to Exodus chapter 26, verse 1. When God gave instructions for building the temple during the reign of King Solomon, he commanded that two 15-foot-tall cherubim statues be placed in the Holy of Holies, according to 1 Kings chapter 6, verses 23 through 28, and that the figures of cherubim be carved into the walls and doors of the temple, according to 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 29. And later, in 1 Kings chapter 9, verse 3, we read that God approved of such things, saying to Solomon, I have consecrated this house which you have built and put my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. God's blessing on the temple is certain evidence that he doesn't oppose having statues and sacred images in places of worship. Another example where God commanded the making of a statue is Numbers chapter 21, verses 6 through 9. The Israelites were suffering from venomous snake bites, and in order to heal them, God instructed Moses to construct a bronze serpent and set it on a pole so that those who were bitten could look upon it and be healed. We read about this in Numbers chapter 21, verses 6 through 9. Now, God did later command that the bronze serpent be destroyed, but only because the Israelites started worshiping it as a god. There in 2 Kings chapter 18, verse 4. It wasn't having the bronze serpent that was the problem. It was the worship they were offering it. Now that we know what God is not commanding in Exodus chapter 20, with the Ten Commandments there, the question arises, well, what is he commanding? And this leads us to our second response. What God is forbidding here in Exodus chapter 20, verse 5, is the making of idols. And the context bears this out. Consider the prohibition that precedes it There in verse 3, you shall have no other gods before me. Then after the passage in question, we read, so this would be, I think, verse 6, you shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Given this contextual prohibition of idolatry, it's reasonable to conclude that God's command not to make graven images refers to making images to be worshipped as deities or idols. Accordingly, we note that every time the Hebrew word for graven images, pesel, is used in the Old Testament, it's used in reference to idols or the images of idols. So for example, the prophet Isaiah warns in chapter 44, verse 9, quote, all who make idols, Hebrew word there, pesel, are nothing, and the things they delight in do not profit, their witnesses neither see nor know, that they may be put to shame, close quote. Other examples include, but are not limited to, Isaiah chapter 40, verse 19, chapter 44, verse 17, chapter 45, verse 20, Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 14, and Jeremiah chapter 51, verse 17, and Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 18. Plenty of examples where pesel is used for idols. Now, since making idols is what this commandment in Exodus chapter 20 forbids, the Catholic custom of using statues and images for religious purposes doesn't contradict it, because Catholics don't use statues and sacred images as idols. The whole of paragraph 2132 in the Catechism of the Catholic Church states the following. The Christian veneration of images is not contrary to the first commandment, which proscribes idols. Indeed, the honor rendered to an image passes to its prototype, that is, he or she whom the image represents. And whoever venerates an image venerates the person portrayed in it. The honor paid to sacred images is a respectful veneration, not the adoration due to God alone. So Catholics don't treat statues, or even the people whom the statues represent, as gods. As such, the biblical prohibition of idolatry here in Exodus chapter 20 doesn't apply. Now, this challenge from modern evangelicals shows that there's nothing new under the sun. The Catholic Church dealt with this sort of objection all the way back in the 8th century when it condemned the heresy of iconoclasm at the Second Council of Nicaea in 787. Iconoclasm was the belief that all religious images are superstitious. And in response to this heresy, the council declared that religious images were worthy of veneration and that any respect shown to a religious image is, as I already said, really respect given to the person it represents, quoting, you know, when I was quoting the Catechism. In having images or statues of Jesus, angels, Mary, and the saints in its places of worship, the Catholic Church is simply following the Old Testament precedent of incorporating images of heavenly inhabitants that serve as reminders of who's present with us when we approach God in liturgical worship. The representations of the cherubim in the Old Testament served as reminders that they were heavenly inhabitants present with God. Since humans have been admitted into heaven, according to Revelation 5, 8, 6, 9, and chapter 7, verses 14 through 17, well, it's reasonable to employ representations of them too. So that does it for the first detail and the objection from the graven images. Let's now turn to the second reading of this upcoming Sunday Mass, which again is taken from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 22 through 25. Here's what Paul writes. Jews demand signs and Greeks look for wisdom, but we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are called, Jews and Greeks alike, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. The Catholic Church has been a great patroness of philosophical wisdom, with Augustine, Aquinas being perhaps the greatest representatives of this tradition. And every one of you listening right now pretty much knows that. But some Christians think this emphasis on philosophy in the Catholic tradition contradicts the Bible. And our second reading here for this upcoming third Sunday of Lent is a passage that sometimes is appealed to for support of this claim. How can the Catholic Church promote philosophy? So it might be argued, when Paul clearly says that wisdom is folly. Shouldn't we stick to the preaching of Christ crucified and leave all that Greek wisdom behind? That's how the objection is presented. Now, I deal with this objection in my article for Catholic Answers Magazine online, The Wisdom of God and of the World, and you can access it at Catholic.com. And basically, here's how I respond there. First, if we take God's words, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and the cleverness of the clever," to mean that he disapproves of philosophical reasoning, well then, he, God, would be acting foolishly, for he would be acting contrary to his nature. Think about it. It belongs to our nature as rational animals to have an intellect. And that intellect is naturally directed to contemplating reality. So to engage in philosophy, which is basically the quest to know the ultimate causes of things through natural reason, is a good thing for us as human beings. We're actually functioning properly as human beings when we're philosophizing. And whatever knowledge of reality that we can use to direct our lives toward God, which is the virtue of prudence, a sort of cleverness, it's good that we do so. Therefore, for God to command us to not engage in philosophical reasoning whatsoever would be to command us to act contrary to the good of our nature. Now, for God to command us to act contrary to the good of our nature would be to command us to direct our lives away from Him as our ultimate end or goal. In other words, God would be commanding us to not love Him. But of course, God can't command us to not love Him because that would entail a failure for God to love Himself, which is impossible given God's perfect nature. A failure to love Himself would involve God falling short of being fully actualized in His loving power. Since that can't be, given that God is pure actuality itself, as St. Thomas Aquinas would say, or pure existence itself, He cannot possibly fail to love Himself. Therefore, it can't be that God intends to express disapproval of philosophical reasoning when He says, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and the cleverness of the clever." Nor can this be Paul's intended meaning. For Paul, inspired by the Holy Spirit, wouldn't contradict what we can know by the natural light of human reason. So that, of course, raises the question, what does God, and thus Paul, mean with the words, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and the cleverness of the clever"? Well, we can look to St. Thomas Aquinas here for some help. In his commentary on 1 Corinthians, he writes this, "God does not say absolutely, 'I will destroy the wisdom,' because all wisdom is from the Lord God," and he's quoting Sirach 1:1 there. But, he continues, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, i.e., which the wise of this world have invented for themselves against the true wisdom of God." Because as it says in James 3:15, he's quoting here, "This is not wisdom descending from above, but earthly, sensual, devilish wisdom," right? We can include wisdom there. So God promises to bring an end by the power of the cross to the disordered reason by which human beings strive to live for this world and the goods of this world alone. That's what Paul is getting at. Again, Aquinas explains, quote, "Similarly, God doesn't say, 'I will reject prudence or cleverness,' for God's wisdom teaches true prudence, but the prudence of the prudent, i.e., which is regarded as prudent by those who esteem themselves prudent in worldly affairs so that they cling to the goods of this world, or because the prudence of the flesh is death," quoting Romans 8:6. This tendency to live for worldly affairs alone drives our attempts to explain the world. Just as we tend to live only for the goods of this world, we tend to explain the world only in terms of the things in this world, restricting our explanations to, say, natural causes, and not allowing recourse to a transcendent reality or the possible light of divine revelation. This is what Aquinas means when he says in his commentary that we just read, on account of the vanity, or in the same commentary that we just read, he also says this, "On account of the vanity of his heart, man wandered from the right path of divine knowledge." According to Dominican priest Father Thomas Joseph White in his 2014 Nova et Vetera article, St. Thomas Aquinas and the Wisdom of the Cross, it's this misery of the human condition that the wisdom of God in the crucified Christ heals. Quote, quoting Father White, "opening reason up to an authentic horizon of intellectual universality," close quote. In the words of Aquinas, quote, "God brought believers to a saving knowledge of Himself by other things, which are not found in the natures of creatures, close quote. That's coming from Aquinas' commentary on 1 Corinthians. A teacher who recognizes his students are missing the point, if he wants them to learn, will change track and use another example or explanation to get the point across, right? Well, similarly, God, recognizing that man has a hard time understanding the meaning of their lives and the world with the language of nature, employs the language of the cross to convey that meaning. And so that's what Aquinas is getting at here. St. Paul is getting at. He's not saying that God is rejecting wisdom itself and philosophical wisdom. He's not rejecting natural explanations of things. He is simply saying that sometimes there are people who restrict themselves only to philosophical reasoning and only to explanation of things according to this world and seeking the goods of this world, and restrict themselves or exclude themselves from appealing to any sort of transcendent reality like God. That sort of wisdom that's restrictive in its nature, that's what's being rejected. Okay, so I mentioned how, you know, St. Paul is saying, like, through the preaching of the cross, he intends to convey true meaning for life, sometimes that people by the natural light of human reason miss. And so the question becomes, well, what's that meaning? And the answer is, it's love. The language of love that Jesus expresses on the cross opens man's reason up to the reality that we're called to, namely a loving relationship with God the Father through Jesus Christ by the power of the Holy Spirit. In the words of Father White, the love of Christ crucified redeems the human mind by introducing it at once to the heights and depths of the mystery of the Trinity. And so another question is, well, how do we achieve such a loving relationship? And the answer is by imitating the crucified Christ and offering our lives for others in self-sacrificial love. So rather than opposing philosophical wisdom with the wisdom of the cross, Paul, and ultimately God, invites us to allow the wisdom of the cross to redeem or heal human reason and elevate it to the noble place of serving the faith. The Catholic Church, therefore, can continue being the patroness of philosophical wisdom without fear of contradicting the Bible, ordering philosophical knowledge to its proper end, which is union with God. That is what is at the heart of the mystery of St. Paul's teaching here. Okay, let's now turn to the gospel reading, which is John chapter 2, verses 13 through 25. And it's John's report of Jesus overturning the money changers in the temple. Now, I'm not going to read the passage in its entirety because there's no one detail that I want to focus on. Rather, I want to address a challenge that's posed by skeptics concerning the placement of this event within the chronology of Jesus' ministry here in John's gospel. Here's the objection. John places the cleansing of the temple at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, but Matthew, in chapter 21, verses 12 and following, and Mark, chapter 11, verses 15 through 19, and we could even throw in there Luke, they place the cleansing of the temple at the end of Jesus' ministry. And so the question becomes, well, how can we trust the Gospels when they don't even agree on when Jesus did something, like cleanse the temple? Biblical scholars have offered several ways to reconcile this discrepancy in the Gospels. And by discrepancy, I just mean there are some differences here, right? One might say alleged errors, and I emphasize and underscore alleged, but by discrepancy, I just mean there are discrepancies. There's differences here. But there are two ways that are offered that are most prominent in order to reconcile these discrepancies. The first is that John relocated this event for thematic purposes, which is something ancient authors did and were permitted to do so. And on this view, John put this event at the beginning of Jesus' ministry as a kind of headline for Jesus' ministry and a sort of tee-up as to what sort of response he would receive throughout that ministry. The other view is that Jesus did this on two different occasions, at the beginning and the end of his ministry. As many scholars point out, there are enough differences in the accounts, the differences of the details in the accounts that actually support a lack of identification. In other words, this two clearings hypothesis. Our colleague and good friend at Catholic Answers, Jimmy Akin, has an article at Catholic.com on this very issue. And I think the title is something like, How Many Times Did Jesus Cleanse the Temple? If you type that in the search engine at Catholic.com, Jimmy's article will come up. Now, furthermore, it's reasonable to think that Jesus would have visited the temple several times. Well, it's not even just reasonable. We know he visited the temple several times within his public ministry. And John even notes this throughout his gospel, right? And given that Jesus isn't one to remain silent in the face of abuses, and it's unlikely the abuses in the temple would have ceased after his first reprimand, it's not far-fetched to say that Jesus would have done this twice in his ministry, one at the beginning, as John records, and one at the end, as Matthew, Mark, and Luke record. So since we have plausible explanations of the discrepancy between John, Matthew, and Mark, and Luke, there's no reason to reject these accounts as historically unreliable. Well, my friends, that does it for this episode of the Sunday Catholic Word. The readings for this upcoming third Sunday of Lent, Year B, provide us with plenty of apologetical material. There's material that leads to discussions about the possession and use of religious statues and images in religious spaces, the good of philosophy within the Catholic intellectual tradition, and the historical reliability of the Gospels, particularly John's Gospel. These are all topics worth reflecting on in preparation for apologetical dialogues. As always, I want to thank you for subscribing to the podcast. Please be sure to tell your friends about it and invite them to subscribe as well at SundayCatholicWord.com or MrSundayPodcast.com. You might also want to check out the other great podcasts in our Catholic Answers Podcast Network, Cy Kellett's Catholic Answers Focus, Trent Horn's The Council of Trent, of course, Joseph Heschmeyer's Shameless Popery, and Jimmy Akin's A Daily Defense, all of which can be found at Catholic.com. My friends, I hope you have a blessed third Sunday of Lent, Year B. Peace.
Thank you for listening to the Sunday Catholic Word. Find more great shows by visiting CatholicAnswersPodcasts.com or just search for Catholic Answers wherever you listen to podcasts.